your introduction and welcome. And thank you for the organization of this evening. I'm happy to be back in Vancouver and to be able to speak a bit more about existential issues in dealing with life, difficult life situations. This is why existential analysis has been developed, to help ourselves and to help people in general to deal better with life and to come along with the difficulties and understand difficulties of life and to come to a better understanding of what is life and how we can be more ourselves in life and encounter others and such find some fulfillment in our existence, which is not always easy, especially when we are confronted with trauma, injuries, pain, losses, etc. And this will be the hard stuff for tonight, that we look at this side of the existence. I thought to go through with you through these chapters to speak a bit on the human reality of everyday life, then to look what is injury and what is trauma and how we can restore or keep dignity and find meaning, and finally to how we can overcome trauma. I will give the story of a person who really suffered a lot in her life, and then as an example for injuries, and I will speak about trauma in concentration camps and see what Viktor Frankl says about this and how he and others could overcome the trauma. Well, living our life means that we are often enough hurt and suffer from injuries, physical, but more than the physical injuries, although we are in a hospital here, we will speak about the psychological injuries. And we pinpoint a side of our reality which is not so well, not so pleasant, which we do not like to look at, but which happens often enough, and we are normally living with this side of our reality more in a silent way. We keep it within ourselves. We don't speak so much about it. And I will help you, I want to endorse your capacity to speak about what is difficult, what is painful, what is hurting, because it's better we speak it up and exchange it, then we can be better ourselves. So, suffering, pain, injuries belong to existence. It is normal. It happens. And when it happens, we are sometimes consternated. We are kicked at the teeth. We are questioned until the basis of our existence. The relationship is in danger when we are hurt in relationships, or when we are heavenly hurt, or when we experience snide remarks, when we are not taken seriously, when we are betrayed or ridiculed in relationships, or in the working place. The same may happen, that we are treated unjustly, that we are postponed, that we are exposed to an abuse of power, that we are bullied, or that we suffer from a dismissal which we didn't count with, that we are fired unjustly sometimes. It's hurting. There are so many situations in our life where we experience this pain and hurt and trauma in families. When in families the sibling, the brother, the sister is favored, when we do not feel loved in family, when we are disinherited, or more secretly, when there happens abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, abuse in families. Heavy traumas are rapes, kidnapping, hostage taking, brutally being knocked down, and the most brutal or the most terrible way where we confronted with trauma is war. War is really devastating human beings, the psyche. A generation who has been in war is a traumatized generation. Injuries and traumas may not only happen by other people, it may also happen by fateful happenings which traumatize, like the terrible tsunami which killed thousands, ten thousands of people, or an earthquake, or an airplane crash. In personal life, apart from that, what happens by other people and by fates, in personal life, catastrophic news may also traumatize. The diagnosis of a cancer, the sudden death of a person, an accident. In all these situations, we are traumatized by a horror to which we are exposed, or by a shock which makes tremble our assumptions, basic assumptions of life. This is very fundamental in trauma, especially. We will come back to this. And the person who is dealing with traumatic situations and injuries is in front of a question of one's life. The question, how can I continue? Because I didn't imagine life that way. I don't know if life is possible at all under these traumatic circumstances. When in life such things happen, is it still worth it to live? So these are really existential questions which come up in the experience of trauma and shatter our human reality. So the structure of existence is in question. Existence means we are exposed to a world, exposed to otherness, exposed to something or somebody who is not ourselves, who is different. Being exposed is a classical understanding of human existence in existential philosophy. Exposed in the world means that we are thrown into this life. We are not asked, we are there. We are. Sometimes people don't even really want to be there, but we are there. We have to deal with this reality, with our existence. We are exposed to tragedies which come along with being there. We are exposed to the limitation in power, in means, in time, in possibilities. All this may hurt. We are vulnerable. As human beings, we are fundamentally vulnerable. As all living beings, we are vulnerable. Stones are not vulnerable, but we are vulnerable because we have a nervous system. We have blood circulating in our body. And in the psychological level, we are vulnerable because we are in a constant exchange with the outer world and with ourselves. In all these places, in all these spots, interventions may happen which destroy the normal processes. And in human existence, we are inevitably confronted with the incomprehensible, with the absurd, with the meaningless. And the question is always, how can we overcome? How can we continue to exist under these conditions, under these circumstances, and they belong to life? It's not saying because I'm not clever enough, not bright enough, that I can escape such situations. No, it is there, inevitably there. We as human beings, how can we remain humans? How can we, when we are so disabled by the situation, by the fate, by what other people do us, when it is so hurting, when we bleed, when we are raw, when all is in question and scattered until the inner bones, how can we remain living in a way which is still worth living and remain ourselves? How can we keep up relationship to others, to the world, to ourselves? How can we stand behind us? How can we keep up respect for ourselves and for others? And be faithful with ourselves. Live an appreciation, a self-esteem. Keep on the line of life, of existence, of going into a future when the condition of life is such that we are always exposed and we certainly have to suffer sometimes, from time to time, from pain and injuries and hurts. This is about the frame of this presentation for tonight, and it shows an area which all of us know. Let us now go a bit deeper. What is an injury? What produces injury? And what is the object which is injured in an injury? I try to give you an access to injury as a basis for the understanding of trauma, an access which you certainly can connect easily with your own experience in life. Let's take a physical injury, like a cut with a knife, or an abrasion, or a contusion, or a crushing. These are all injuries. In medicine we call them open injuries, when blood is flowing, or closed injuries, like a contusion, where no blood is flowing to the outside. Injuries lead to a violent destruction of an integral whole. This is something which we can easily read from a physical injury. When a knife is cutting my skin, that's an injury. Why? Because the knife violently goes through the skin and destroys the integrity of the body, which is a whole. The knife, or it may be injuries by a fist or by a stone, break through violently a border of something which delimits an own, a proper being. Like in that case, in a physical injury, the skin. It brings the joint, it presses apart what is joined. It splits. The own, the skin, is not strong enough to withstand that power, that momentum, that vehemence, that energy. The skin can no longer neutralize that pressure which comes from the knife. It cannot resist. And therefore it gives in, and this giving in leads to the destruction. We call such power violence. Violence is the breaking through a limitation, the breaking through a border, and which the border cannot resist anymore. This is this application of power against the resistance is violence. This is the easiest definition of violence, and the most basic understanding of violence. So every injury contains violence. Violent destruction, with the consequence that the function is decreased, and or the own is lost, like in a physical injury, blood is flowing out. Integrity is destroyed. The lymphy cannot be kept within the limits. And at the same time, there's the experience that pain shows up. Pain is a signal to the center of organization in the body, to the brain. And the characteristics of pain are that it is always pushing itself into the foreground. It is a primary signal which must precede any other information, because where there is pain, there is a signal that something is in danger, something vital is in danger. Also, not only in physical pain, but also in psychological pain. So this underlines already, this understanding helps us to see that when we have psychological pain, we should not try to put it aside. We should focus it and take it and try to understand it. It is a signal that something vital is in danger. And it is therefore disturbing. It doesn't allow us to continue business as usual. When there are pain, it needs more attention and time. And therefore it is disturbing our normal life. A tooth pain, go first to the dentist. A broken heart, don't do business as usual. Do it to the minimum. Try to have time for yourself, to cure yourself. It has, of course, different qualities, pain. It can be like a cut, it can be a bright pain or a dark pain or a numbing pain. And it produces a feeling of being a victim. We are exposed, perceived as a victim, suffering. We sometimes are not culpable or the reason for this pain, and it produces often a rejective attitude to pain. That's normal, because the pain is nothing pleasant, and therefore we are against pain and try to not feel it. Watch the pain reliefs, all this medication. Pain shows up and has to tell something. And of course sometimes it's good to relieve the pain, to be able to function and to do something which has to be done at the moment. But a constant pain relief is against the nature. Except there are some indications, of course, some diseases which must be maintained and not controlled with pain reliefs. What is the pain telling us? It is the most intensive push to do something. It is urgent. We have to remove the cause of the pain, the cause of the injury, or to restore the wholeness, the integrity, that the wound can heal, accrue, that we finally are healed again. That we healing means regaining the integrity, the wholeness. And it needs a positioning. A positioning which means that I really confront the situation which produces pain. The physical pain, of course, is we look at what is hurting and try to remove the thorn, or we remove what is burning us, etc. But on the psychological level, it's the same thing. It needs that we take it, that we face it, that we look at it, that we oppose it, that we recognize the circumstances and understand how it could happen that this injury happened. And this understanding is at the same time a prevention, that it doesn't happen so easily again, because we understand the circumstances and we learn how to deal with it, how to prevent it, how to change the circumstances that the pain doesn't come up so easily again. This has a parallel in the psychological and spiritual, personal level of injuries and pain. Also on this level, this is an injury or a destruction of the integrity. On the psychological level, the destruction of the integrity happens more clandestinely. It's not so visible like when we are cut by a knife. On the psychological level, it is comparable with being infected by bacteria, viruses, poison, being poisoned. It's not visible. And it can happen suddenly or slowly. It can develop suddenly or slowly, like for instance in ingestion of a bad stuff, of deteriorated food, and we have an poisoning of food. Or it can be chronic, like the tuberculosis or syphilis. You don't feel it very much. It's very on a very low level of having pain or feeling suffering, but it has a tremendous potential of destruction, although it starts so slowly. On the psychological level, it's the same. We have the same possibilities. The constant traumatization on a low level, which is taken in itself, it's nothing, but over the years of a childhood, over the years of a relationship. So watch it. Or it can begin with a high impact from the beginning on, like a flu, an infection by a virus. In all cases, we have a destruction of integrity. A bacterium or a virus or some chemical poisoning. The integrity is destructed, the own is poisoned, and a destruction of functionality. I would like to talk at this place about a woman whose life is an example of a human being who had to undergo so many sufferings and hurtings on different levels, different psychological levels. And because it shows that how difficult it is for every human being when we are rejected by other people, when we are blamed publicly, when we are left alone, especially when we are in need, when the honor is attacked, on a sexual level when a woman is called a slut publicly in a village or so. And this was the case with this woman. When she came into therapy, she was 50 years old. I call her here Elsa. Elsa, the symptom why she came was simply because she couldn't function very well sometimes. She had depressive episodes since 20 years. She didn't care very much for the depressive episodes because it was so long time that she suffered from them. But in the last couple of years, the depressive episodes became more intensive and longer. And it resulted that she wasn't able to do her work in special days, like around Christmas. She became regularly, year after year, so depressive that she couldn't prepare Christmas, and the family had to do it, her husband, the children, and she suffered from this, and the family suffered from this. And what she could describe was that her feeling of depression was combined with a constant feeling of worthlessness. And there was a silent doubt in her if the others, her family, mainly her family, really love her, like her, or not. She was not sure about this. And so she took normal situations as very bad signals for her. For instance, when the children, they were between 15 and 25, when they went out and didn't tell her where they went to, she took it as a sign that they don't love me. This misinterpretation was constantly hurting her again and augmenting her injury. And she reacted in these situations always in the same manner. Although she was depressive, she couldn't stand for not being informed, and she asked. She asked the children, she asked her husband, and she asked them so much that she got on the nerves of the family. And then the children reacted rejectively. They felt under pressure, narrowed. But she couldn't stop this asking. She didn't understand why. She had to clarify, because, and when we talked about it, it became clear why. Because behind this asking, there was her anxiety. Am I not valuable enough for them that they tell me what they are going to do or what they did? Do they love me enough? It wasn't conscious to her what was pushing her to this asking. But the reaction of the family and some friends, of course, was really rejecting, and so she got the feeling that she was right, they don't love me. This is a vicious circle, and she is contributing constantly that it becomes worse and worse, and so her depression augmented. What she could say was when she was asking the family members or the other people that she felt a lump in her throat, and she couldn't breathe really in such situations. And even now, when she talked about it, she felt the same lump in the throat. And she finally could say by her words that the lump means, or is a signal for, I am not loved enough. In that moment when she expressed this, after being asked, when she expressed this, this lump even changed and became a stranglehold. She had really hard time even to breathe at that moment, although she was healthy, physically healthy. the underlying feeling of worthlessness became so evident. She couldn't bear this feeling of worthlessness and possibly not being loved enough, or almost surely not being loved enough. She couldn't bear it in that bright light of consciousness. It was as if the soul bursts, explodes, she said. And she felt like being in a straitjacket. She would have loved to cry, but she has stopped crying for quite some time, because it was getting on his nerves to her husband. She would prefer to scream even. She says, she continues, if I look at that, I feel that I would like to scream. But she didn't have the courage, and she didn't feel the right to scream. So she always was silent, even now. But she felt the impulse, she felt the pressure, the need to scream it out. She was deeply convinced that if I cry or scream only for me, if I do something only for me, then it's not important. For me, it's not important. And when it is not important for others, it's not important for me. So, she added, abashed, when it's not important for others that I scream, it's not important for me. She was really left alone with herself and didn't have a good access. Why did it happen? We had a closer look to her biography and to these injuries which led her to this distance to herself, to this loss of herself. She started to talk about her hurtings. She says that people around her always tried to take her away what belonged to her and to give it to other people. She remembered many situations. She took one of them and said, there was a situation with my handbag. I had a nice handbag. But she was about 12, and there was a picture to be done for an event for the grandmother, and she and her cousins and were on the picture, and somebody came and took her the handbag away and gave it to her cousin, because she looks nicer with her handbag, and she let it happen. So many little infections, little destructions, which do not respect her as a person and do not give her the esteem and the value which she deserves. She felt that she wasn't loved or liked that much as all the others, as her brother, as her cousins. She says, all what came from me was bad. I was always the worst compared with my brother. Even she, her own perception, gave this understanding right. I was really the worst. I was not so good. This is the picture of a person who suffers from devaluation, putting back, injustice, to such a degree that she was alienated to herself. And then it came even worse. Her honesty was in question. She says, I never made anything clandestinely. I always fought openly, but I was hit for this. I put it up even when the whole village, she lived in a village, spoke badly about me. I had even to fight for my later husband. I had always to work hard had always to put through what I wanted against all other people. I see, I have never, it was never allowed to me to be as I am, even when I was a child. There was only one luck in her life, her father. He was the only one who was proud on her, who really loved her, and this has balanced quite a lot and stabilized her. Otherwise she wouldn't have been able to live until her 50s with her experiences. But from the others, she was criticized, rejected, even for actions which she made for others. For instance, when she groomed herself, when she wanted to see her mother in the hospital. So she was full of self-doubts. People always gave her to understand, you are different than the others. To you doesn't belong anything. You have no right. You are, at the outset, the bad. And I always had to prove everything. And I was always the one who didn't belong to others. I didn't even the cousins didn't have the right to play with me because I was so bad. Their parents took them away from her. I didn't have a family. I didn't have relatives. When she said that, again the lump in her throat was there. But now this lump was irradiating until her shoulders and started to hurt her. She felt not only a lump, she felt now pain. Earlier, she says, I became excited, I became furious, I have cracked the whip because I couldn't stand it anymore. Today, I'm just sad. Since my brother-in-law ostracized me, since then, I stopped it. I cannot even speak about me, about what I suffered. I feel like being paralyzed. I am knocked out. In the village, they said, this whore sleeps with my brother in my apartment. Her brother-in-law was saying that. And my mother believed it. I couldn't defend myself. My mother threw me out of the house. She reprimanded me. Whore, also. Nobody stood up for me. Not even my later husband. He, at that time, had chased other women. He lied on me. I was lonely, left alone. I just suffered. This was my world. And from then, from that time, from my childhood until this adolescent time, it remained in me, I am bad, I am cheap, one cannot love me. And this wound coined her life. It is quite extreme, but it's not so rare that people have to suffer things like this. It coined her life, her experience and her behavior for 25, almost 30 years. And for the first time, now she could cry about it. Finally, eventually she could say how disappointed she is that she didn't have a mother as she liked to have. as she believed. Finally, she could cry that she didn't have a good mother, and she understands why she withdraw herself, and at the same time couldn't be alone. She needed others around her, because her life was so torn apart and tensed. There was always something which hurt her continuously over the years. It didn't come into peace and calmness. Nobody was there who accepted this, who has seen it, who shared it with her. And alone she was over-demanded by that pain, by that injuries. This making herself clear which hurts and how many injuries she had, this recognizing and evaluating and judging of suffered meannesses, this grieving finally made her strong, and she could overcome the depression and the social anxiety step by step. It lasted about a year, and then she overcame her depression and never again had depressive phases, and was, and the anxiety was reduced, and she didn't get on the nerves of her family and her husband. We can take many other examples. Always there is an injury, a hurt of the integrity, of the wholeness. Every hurting, every injury comes along with a taken aback, a personal taken aback, which is the central in each psychic personal hurt. One feels questioned by the situation, questioned in the being oneself. Who am I ultimately? Can people treat me that way? This is a difficult question, especially for a young person, when we are treated badly. The victim of an abuse questions the same. Do I have a value which is founded in myself, a value out of myself? The betrayed asks the same question. And who has a fatal suffering, an accident, a heavy diagnosis, an operation, asks similar questions. What does it have to do with me? Why do I have to suffer this? What is my fault? Did I deserve it? Does this do justice to me? Did I cause it? Is it my guilt? Can I be seen publicly with what I have? Or do I have to suffer from shame? So this psychological injury of the wholeness brings up this shaking experience of taken aback. And it brings up a blow, a quake, that this happened to me. I didn't count with it. What happens is unexpected. It doesn't fit into my image of the reality, of the situation, of my life. And this blows my self-understanding, my concept of life. And it leads to a destruction of what's valuable. Something which has a value for me is lost, is cut, is shaken, is destroyed, is taken away, until, which goes so deep that our vital feeling of life is in danger. and it questions the future. How shall I continue? What can become out of it? How can I recreate? In a hurry, the processing capacity is acutely overwhelmed. And this becomes understandable if we think about the cornerstones of our, what are the cornerstones which are damaged in an injury. All fundamental dimensions of existence are in danger or are hit, especially the relation to oneself. So the relation is this arrow is the strongest arrow. The relation to myself when I'm injured, like in the case of this lady, this relation, I do not stand behind me anymore. If I lose myself, this is the main issue of this level of injuries and pain and suffering and hurtings. And therefore, since all four dimensions of existence which hold us in existence are shaken, the capacity to process the experiences is paralyzed. The structure of existence is weakened. The structure cracks, is fractured. And the power to deal with what is hurting is temporarily faded away. So slowly the process of elaboration can start again, especially when we start with delimitating and protecting this third dimension, the being oneself, and then when we come to accepting and enduring the reality and to the grief process, and so we find our orientation again. In the middle of this process, the substrate of the hurting is the ego. Ego woven, it's here in German, ego, the ich, interwoven in his inner and outer relationships, which make it a whole. That part described injuries, hurtings. But now there exist experiences which are the utmost injuries. We call them trauma. Trauma is the blow of the pure existence. We have to see that amongst the traumatizations, the simple traumatizations, what that lady suffered from are simple traumatizations, because these traumatizations are understandable. They happen more or less in an everyday life. This is normal meanness. But there are traumas which are going far beyond this. The trauma in the strongest sense, the trauma which we treat in trauma therapy, is the massive form of injury. Trauma is an unprepared, massive, brutal being exposed, exposed to death or to a serious physical injury. It may be the only exposure to death, but it may also be this heavy trauma may also happen when we see somebody else exposed to that death, especially when there is a relationship to that other person. And it produces an intensive subjective reaction of fear, of terror, of helplessness, of shock. It's this is an overwhelming and inconceivable dimension of brutality connected with a heavy reaction. Over 50% of the human beings in our societies experience at least once in their life such a kind of trauma. This is very much. The symptoms of such trauma or such traumatization leads often, when it is not elaborated and not integrated, to the development of a post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, with rehearsal of the trauma, flashbacks, to see the traumatizing situation again and again, like in a movie. You dream, also during the day, you suddenly see, you work, you do something, you see what happened to you again and again. The picture is always present. It produces an avoiding behavior, a preventing avoiding behavior. It produces high irritability and many symptoms, physical symptoms, psychological symptoms. In existential analysis, we can say that trauma destroys these four fundamental dimensions of existence. The fundamental trust into the world. This is the most important effect trauma has, the strongest effect. One cannot trust anymore that life goes on normally, because always there may happen something terrible. There's a constant horror. There is no trust into the being. What is there is not substantial enough. It can deceive. So the fundamental trust in the world, in the being, is destroyed in trauma. This is the utmost experience. The traumatized person lives in constant horror, in constant disbelief that what is there can keep me. This is much more than anxiety. In anxiety, I can still believe that what is there keeps me, that this ground holds me. But the traumatized person has a feeling of insecurity even standing here. Most very traumatized people, which suffer from this real trauma in the strongest, in the pure sense of the term, such persons sometimes are not able to sit on a chair because they feel insecure, and I sit with them on the ground to talk with them, and they constantly feel insecure. Everywhere, every moment, something may happen. They don't know what. This is this loss of fundamental trust. It's not rational. But it's so strong that they are incapable, sometimes incapable to work any longer for a long period of time. The value of life is destroyed. After what happened, life is no longer good. They cannot enjoy. They would feel like betraying themselves if they would enjoy, but they do not even have the capacity, the functioning capacities, to enjoy a good meal or the sunset. They have an idea that this could be nice or good or pleasant, but they somehow do not allow it happen, and at the same time they cannot let it happen. It's really a massive trauma. The value of being oneself as a person. Who am I that it happened to me? Can I really trust on me anymore? I'm not able to work it out. So I lose self-respect, self-esteem. And the meaning of the whole and of everything is lost. What for can this be good? Even persons who are in a good belief, in a religious belief, or so lose this belief, or they know it cognitively, but they cannot feel it anymore. So trauma affects the deepest layers of existence. With all these four dimensions of existence, which are unanchored, especially the fundamental trust, the relation to the world, the arrow which goes below. This may be the trauma, the cause for such a trauma, may be all these experiences we spoke about from in the beginning, the tsunami, the earthquake, the flood, the which produces helplessness, being buried in an earthquake or under an avalanche, or simply to see how somebody gets buried under an avalanche may traumatize in that way. That you see this picture days, day after day, weeks after weeks. What makes trauma so difficult? Let's look now on the dignity and meaning, is that it brings us into a dead end of existence. It makes life, or it makes the situation so inescapable. There is a lack of understanding. There's an experience of being overpowered by reality, that we are exposed to pure incidents, to the destructive arbitrariness and of life, of situations, of reality, of other people. The idea, or that we do not have substantial control on the world, is coming up by this seriousness, brutality, and relentlessness of the situation. It smashes all our picture of reality. We simply didn't think that this is possible what happened to us. This is typical for this severe traumatization. It passes all over all imagination of what is possible. Theoretically, we can imagine a tsunami, but when we experience a tsunami, when we have been in the middle, when we overcame it by some chance, all people say, I never believed that such a vehemence, such a brutality, such a momentum is possible. I cannot go in the water anymore. Because water I cannot trust. Water deceived me. And it is, in our society, it is even more likely to be traumatized. But why? Because we live in a time where we have more or less the feeling we can control everything. Infections, nature, everything is under our control by technical means, and science does it. And our culture and civilization tells us that we make use of the world, we enjoy the world, we make it happen as we want it, to a great deal, to that deal which is dangerous or which can be a threat, we have it under control. This is, but the experience of trauma shows us that what we do is like playing in with the sand. It's not real. There is a reality which is much more powerful than what we can do. A trauma of this extreme dimension is the experience of concentration camp, the deportation into a concentration camp, and living there, and luckily overcome it. There are few persons with whom we connect the experience of concentration camp like Viktor Frankl, he's one of the most famous survivors of a concentration camp. He lived 2.5 years in concentration camps in Poland and Germany, at that time German Reich, Third Reich. And he had to undergo experiences which we normally don't believe or don't see to be real. I assume that many of you read his book, his famous book, Man's Search for Meaning, where he describes these experiences. He survived by chance. He had to suffer from this the arbitrariness of the capos and the SS. And when he came home, he was hardly to break, but he didn't. In the contrary, he grew with this experience, which is also possible. But there are areas of his experience in his life, in his biography, in his inner world, which have damages which continued, which remained. There were scars, but also wounds which remained a lifelong, losses, questions of guilt. Even in his 80s, he sometimes dreamt about this, and he could even start to cry when he thought back. So, having experienced such a trauma and having it worked over and taken it as a chance to talk to people, to work with it in psychology, even then the scars and the wounds remain. In his book, Man's Search for Meaning, he describes this process of being traumatized and what made him traumatized. He speaks about the first shock when they arrived in the concentration camp. This was a horror. All suffered from the same, and he describes what it was. There was first a horror about what they have seen there. This picture of reality in the camp, this having been taken away all clothes, this being treated like animals, this sudden onset of fight all against everybody. This was another terror. He didn't recognize his people, his colleagues. Under these extreme situations at the beginning, there was such a fight. Nobody was reliable anymore. And there was a big suffering after this loss of relationship. There was a big suffering of the loss of all human dignity. They lost their clothes, they lost their names, they got received numbers and had to call themselves by numbers and have been treated as objects. And there was no perspective, hopelessness. These four elements which Frankl describes have a surprising similarity with the four dimensions of existence. The effect in the first couple of hours was that there was such a shock that the inmates were paralyzed. They just looked on, they observed and didn't move. They were willingness. Then, slowly, in the evening and the next day, they became aware that now their life has totally changed. They have to close the past life. And from now on, their life has a before and an after. It was separated. There is no continuation of life possible anymore. This is now a new situation, an extreme situation, where they have to live in and to adjust. And the adjustment brought about the consequences of this initial trauma. There was a pervasive apathy. Their apathy had no limits. They were inwardly blunt, indifferent, dead. There was such an amount of horror experiences that all the normal movements of sentiments stopped, terminated. There was only one thing which they could feel: the injustice in the way how they were treated, the arbitrariness, the mockery. This hurt. But other feelings were no longer around. Apathy was reigning in their life. And another consequence was the withdrawal of themselves to the inner life. They withdraw from the immediate circumstances and primitivize, as he says it. All other interests were reduced. Surviving was the only value. All other values have been devaluated. According to the saying of Bertolt Brecht, first comes the food, then the moral. It was a dehumanization in this. They became so much like animals. A third consequence was the loss of oneself. The loss of the feeling to be a person at all. The value of the own being person. The idea to have some freedom, to be able to decide, was gone. One was part of a big mass, a molecule in a big mass. And fourth, there was a loss of the present and the future. They had the feeling this is only provisional, that's not real. What is there, what possibly becomes, has no reality. Despite it was so horrifying, they couldn't somehow not take it as real. What counted was only the past. That was life. But that was the experience here, is no longer life. And this seduced them to let them go, to resign, because everything has no meaning. What for? You have the same reactions, the same type of reaction, the same structure of reactions in other kinds of trauma, in violence, in sexual abuse, or in hostage taking. This is a totally changed life. The normal doesn't function anymore. So, again, we can see here the parallels to the four dimensions of existence. The basic questions of existence are shattered. The question for security, reliability in the world doesn't exist anymore. No, nothing is reliable. The experience of the valuable, the important, the traumatized looks only for overcoming the situation, and they don't look for having pleasure, for relational values. They don't feel values. the self-value, the dignity which is related with self-value, with the capacity to make decisions, with the capacity to live responsibly, is lost. And no hope, no perspective how this can continue. It's simply, I'm provisionally there, whatever will happen, with a great apathic feeling, they take it. Here, the first two dimensions of existence, this being and trusting the world, the fundamental trust, and the fundamental value, this feeling of something valuable in life, these two dimensions, to deal with them means to take time. They need time and that we make new experiences. But the other two dimensions, the third and the fourth dimension, they can be used to work on the, can be specially used to work on the trauma and they help to overcome the trauma, as Frankl describes. We can do with the first two fundamental motivations or dimensions of existence, we can work a bit more than Frankl described at this time, but he may use mainly from the third and the fourth dimension, namely the being oneself, to not give up oneself. In the concentration camp, he and they detected that they have some possibilities, that there is some freedom, and they make use of this, which helped them to preserve dignity and to see the perspective, to look for a perspective, to fight for that perspective. The experience of trauma certainly brings up the big question of meaning. We will have now a closer look to meaning and response and decision making, how this helped Frankl and his colleagues in the concentration camp. Of course, such experiences question the meaning of life. Such an amount of suffering, it brings up the question, what for? Trauma and hurtings are meaningless in itself, and we experience them as meaningless, and it's natural to experience them as meaningless. What meaning has an accident? What meaning has a violence, a violation? What meaning has a murder? What meaning has a sudden death of a person? We can't know. It would be a mistake to pretend that we know what meaning it has. This would be an ontological transgression. Maybe we have and we can have some anticipating feeling or some hope or some belief that it may have a meaning, that it may happen in the hands of God, for instance. We may even have reflections and thoughts and which may point towards something valuable. These are very personal experiences, very deep personal experiences. They belong in the realm of religion and philosophy, but not in the realm of psychology. Psychology has nothing to say about that. What meaning has a violation? What meaning does it have when a 2-year-old child is dying by cancer? What meaning does it have that we are on the earth? That we are born? We don't know. It can have, we can find some meaning when we look at what we can do in a positive sense with what happened, with what is there. When we, for instance, grow personally, become stronger, when we become deeper, then it has an existential meaning. Then we make a meaning out of the situation. This, the lack of an answer to this question, what for, gives the trauma the specific vehemence. And the trauma can enter uncheckedly into the personality. Because there is nothing we can oppose to the effect of trauma when we do not have an answer of what for, when we do not find it. It is rehearsing all the time. As long as we find something we can oppose to it. Trauma is degrading. Because there are at least three elements which make it so degrading. The simple fact that we have to suffer in trauma something meaningless is degrading. I don't understand. I must carry something something which has no value, which is not good for anything, which is simply destroying, which is meaningless. It is degrading because it is, a second element, destroying the integrity. It is destroying something of my own, but with what I identify. It is a regardless breaking through of the own borders. It leads to a loss of myself. In alienation. I'm a victim to what happens to me. And it is meaningless, it is degrading or dehumanizing because it is because we experience that we are humiliated by others when trauma is done by other people. Wantonness, the arbitrariness, the scoff, the derision, the mockery, in an excruciating dealing with the victims is extremely degrading. The reaction towards this dehumanization is that the people fight for dignity and meaning, or they give up. The reaction is that this reaction is very central, not only in primary traumatization, but also in secondary traumatization. Secondary traumatization is when we see somebody being traumatized, are not traumatized by ourselves, or personally traumatized. Because when we see victims which are treated badly by other people, we empathize, we identify, especially strongly when we belong to the same family, to the same nation, when we have ethnical belongings. There have been investigations about suicidal attempts, which show that, for instance, the black widows in Chechnya or the Palestinians, the Al-Qaeda fighters, that they have been traumatized first before they did the suicidal attempts. There in Palestinians, it has been found, showed young people between 15 and 21 videos where other Palestinians have been treated brutally by Israeli soldiers, or mainly Israeli soldiers. Some of these videos were realistic videos, others have been made artificially, because we know that in the age between 15 and 21, people are extremely sensitive for injustice, and they identify with their country, with their people, and they are artificially traumatized, and then with traumatized people, there is a before and an after. And this afterlife, this having this trauma makes them so extremely hyperactive to do whatever they can to overcome their pain. In their identification with the victims, they have the feeling of vengeance, of an impulse of vengeance, and punishing justice. They feel like a sacred iron, and they are ready to produce the utmost pain to others, a similar pain they have in themselves. And therefore they don't care anymore for their lives. The meaning of their life is to the vengeance, to produce that pain to the others who were the perpetrators, who were the person who produced that trauma in them. It is a similar procedure in the malignant narcissism. In malignant narcissism, they have extreme pain in themselves, and they produce the pain in others and make them suffer and even kill them in a very sadistic way, and they can do it and feeling pleasure because it does so good to their hurt soul. It is understandable, it's human. Every one of us could be a victim of such traumatization, and if it happens even in a religious belief, when there is, for instance, an Islamic belief which gives them the idea that when you do that, you will get 70 virgins in the heaven and so on. It is a consistent system, and it's very natural that people become absolutely radical. The question is, therefore, how can the dignity be maintained? How can one get rid of the suffering if not doing the vengeance? There are personal ways, of course. It doesn't need to be reduced by vengeance. The personal dealing with suffering, with that suffering, the traumatic suffering, needs an attitude to stand aside by oneself. And there are, in existential philosophy and psychology, there are two main ways described to this. The first one is the way of Camus. Camus says, Albert Camus, you have to confront the absurdity of existence. Life itself is absurd, has no meaning. But you as a human being, you can stand up against absurdity because you are free. And you can make use of your freedom and do what the gods didn't want that you do. And he takes Sisyphus as an example that you can stand up against fate, even against God. And he says that Sisyphus can take over his work to push up that stone onto the hill, and when it is on the top, the stone will fall down again, and he has to do that eternally. And he has the freedom to take over a different attitude. And instead, the attitude of being a victim of the gods and having to suffer from their vengeance because for what he did, you can take over a defiant position and And in spite of the task he has to do, you can stand by yourself and say, I do it deliberately. And so you can overcome your faith. So, to face the absurdity and to take over deliberately what you have to do, then you are superior to your faith. You overcome it. Frankl is the same thinking, but on a different background. Frankl says, it is very important that you take over an attitude to what you suffer. But who says that life is absurd by itself? Some situation may appear as absurd, as meaningless, of course. And towards these meaningless situations, situations of great pain, of loss, of suffering, of hurt, you can stand up and say, because I am rooted in life, because I have a connection, a feeling for life, for the value of life in itself, despite of what happened, I continue saying yes to life. This is also a possibility. It's the same architecture like in Camus. Camus puts it in the absurdity of life, and Frankl puts it in the possible meaning of life. So, where do we take the energy for doing that? Camus says, we take the energy of the pride of being human from our consciousness to maintain and keep up our dignity, which belongs to our essence. We are humans, and with that being, with that humanness combined, goes together an incredible capacity of freedom, which is much bigger than one thinks. And Frankl says, yeah, the freedom is there, but we can move the freedom only when we see a meaning. When we have a thou, another person, something valuable, when we do it for a belief or for God or whatever the meaning is, we need a value to which we are belonging, to which we are striving. So, we do not have to get, we can get rid of this trauma by vengeance and by aggressive actions, but we can also deal with it on a personal level by making use of our capacity to decide and to strive for meaning. I give you now Frankl's development of overcoming the trauma in the concentration camp. Central for this is in the attitude of inner dialogue. This helped Frankl to take over an attitude of reconciliation. And he didn't fall into transference and counter-transference. He took a clear position against collective guilt. Why? He wrote in his book that the talking with oneself, this tendency towards the interiorization which came up with the time, this withdrawing from the outer world and living more in the protection of the own intimacy, and talking with oneself in this intimacy, this gave power. This helped to protect the flame of life. And this opened specific capacities for processing. The first one is that in this inner dialogue, experiences like a sunset or the form of the clouds, or to see a flower, even in a concentration camp, there were in some angles flowers, became a source of psychic energy. They led to a verification that verification that beauty still exists. The inmates could give each other on in the morning when they were to find themselves on the place, give them a push and give a command like, look at that, how beautiful the world could be. So the notion that there is still something beautiful, although we do not have much access, just we see a little flower, we see a little and the color of a sunrise, but it is still there. That we could, so if they could feel the power which is inherent to life, that they could feel sometimes that ultimately it could be good to live. We call this in EA today the fundamental value, this feeling life in itself. When we are able to perceive that, life could be good in itself. This was a power taking, despite of all the horrifying and terrible, it was nevertheless good to see that and to see and feel relationships between them and relationships to people who live outside or who were, like for him, the relationship to his wife. She was at that time in another camp. Frankl lived for seeing his parents, his father died, then his mother, to see her mother again and his wife. This was a very strong power for him. Another element is to create an inner distance to that what they immediately experience. He has seen himself like writing or talking about what he experienced immediately. So he pushed a distance between what was going on actually and was alienating the actual situation and putting himself out into a virtual world. It's very powerful how he describes it. Sometimes there was not much humor in concentration camp, but sometimes there was a bit humor, and this was like a relief when they could laugh or smile a bit. The other element was restructuring of life to make use of freedom. This was a configuration of life. They became aware of their inner possibilities, that there is something which cannot be taken away by no power in the world. It was the freedom of attitude and the freedom to make decisions. You may ask, what can they decide in a concentration camp? There are always possibilities. The question is only, do we see them and do we take them as being enough? Or do we say, this is not enough for me? I cite Frankl. One can take away all from a human being in a concentration camp but one, the ultimate human freedom to take a stand to the given conditions in such or such way. And there was a such or such way. So this rest of freedom was fundamental to maintain dignity, for not being preyed upon by the powers of environment, for not feeling oneself as a plaything or an object. They did little things like this freedom consisted, for instance, in saying good morning to the neighbor. It's not much, But I do not have to say good morning. I can say, even in a concentration camp. Can you understand? So little. But it is my decision. And I make real my being a person. And I make use of this capacity to say good morning. And maybe even to raise my eyes and look into his eyes. This is a lot of energy under such extreme conditions. But it is realization of being a person. And be it so little, it happens. It's the step from zero to one. And this step is bigger than the step from one to 100. So to be aware of the little the possibilities may be, to make use of these little possibilities is so important to maintain a self-value, to experience human dignity. Finally, it was very helpful for them to live existential meaning. The awareness and insight was helpful that what we expect from life, this is Frankl saying, the awareness and insight was helpful that what we expect from life never counts in life, but merely what life expects from us. This is this existential turn. Look at what is life expecting from me. I don't expect very much from life in a concentration camp. But the concentration camp, this situation, this being together with others, may expect something from me. And this dimension of existential meaning may go until the ontological meaning, until a belief in an ultimate meaning. Let us come at the end of this talk to some words which Frankl said about his fight and their fight for meaning under these circumstances. He says, what we were looking for was the meaning of life in that totality which also encompasses death, and as such not only represents the meaning of life, but also the meaning of suffering and dying. For this meaning we were fighting. So under the extreme of trauma, of constant traumatic exposure and constant fighting for overcoming, we fought for the meaning of not only of life, but that our dying, our being crashed, our suffering may have some meaning. And he found it mainly in these standing up like Sisyphus against the loss of dignity, against the arbitrariness, to keep a little bit of this freedom, to look for this existential meaning. What is the question of the situation? What am I asked here? What can I do or think? And what for am I still breathing and suffering? This is a very deep human dealing with the shadows of existence. When he came home, life changed again. As in the situation when he came into the concentration camp, now he had to find back into another, into a movie with colors. And he had to learn, and this was the first challenge, to learn to enjoy. He didn't know how enjoying goes, how it works. And this needed time and passion. And the second thing he observed, that after a while he couldn't understand himself anymore. How could one endure it all? It became a question if this was real, what he has undergone. In normal life situations, you cannot take what happens in such an extreme of shadowed life. It is inconceivable. He couldn't believe that this was real, and he couldn't understand how he could endure it and overcome it. So we are capable to much, much more under extreme life circumstances than we normally think or believe. And this slow arriving and adjusting in the new life situation was accompanied by a deep feeling which was the great support for him for the coming years. Something which he took with him and what he described as this: after all he has suffered, there is nothing the human being, he describes it in a general way, there is nothing he need fear anymore except his God. These are the last words in this man's search for meaning, in this description of this traumatic experience, which was really a situation of limit situation of our existence. With these words, he finishes his books. Thank you for your attention. This was a very long talk, and excuse myself, apologize for this length, but if there are two or three questions, we would have time for that, but we close it by the latest at 9 o'clock. Some comments or questions? It needs some time to digest it, possibly, because we normally don't live in such situations, and we have done a deep look into the grammar of existence and the structure of existence, and we are also, I think, at least I feel great respect for human beings who underwent such situations and kept up this strength for life. This is extraordinary, and we are all capable for that. This is really something great. So I'm not sure if somebody has a comment or a question. If it's so, then maybe it's also good to finish it here and to take it home and to ponder a bit and to look after the feelings we get, and to see the big amount of horror which is possible between human beings, but also to see the greatness with which we can take it and overcome it. So, thank you very much. Are you saying something?
Thomas just asked me to close the evening after you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Thomas had to leave. I don't know if that... I'll just speak up. Thomas had to leave, so he asked me just to close the evening. So, first of all, on behalf of the Existential Analysis Society of Canada, we want to thank you all for coming up this evening. So it's wonderful to see new faces and familiar faces, so thank you. And we also want to extend our gratefulness to Alfred, who comes to Canada and teaches us so intricately about themes of life and existence. So if we can give Alfred just a very big hand. great. And there are books, if anybody would like a book, so you'll